The History of the Armed Private Citizen Acting in Self-Defense with No Duty to Retreat. We're looking at how stand your ground laws evolved in America and where the desire for lethal force came from. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. Joining us now is Caroline Light. She's the Undergraduate Studies Director at Harvard University's Program in Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. Her new book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
In your book, you trace the roots of this so-called do-it-yourself security movement, as you call it, DIY movement. 33 states now have some form of stand-your-ground laws. That's stark comparison to just over a decade ago where no states had them. What accounts for this transformation in using guns as self-defense?
It's there are a lot of different vectors that I try to explore in my book, and I call it the do-it-yourself security citizenship movement is sort of the way I'm trying to characterize what I see as a movement of roughly the past couple of decades, roughly around the turn of the century, a switch away from guns as sort of sporting equipment for hunting and whatnot towards this urgent need to have a gun for self-defense. I see also sort of an intersecting fear of terrorism, enhanced fears of undocumented immigration, fears of crime in spite of falling crime rates. In other words, I see this as a fear and anxiety fueled movement to see the individual, the citizen, as the only one who can protect himself. In other words, no one else can protect you. It's every man for himself. So there are a lot of different intersecting kinds of forces involved here, but I see it as evolving specifically with the turn of the century. And in the wake of 9/11, all of these different things come together to infuse the citizen with this urgent need to defend himself.
And this core ideal of what you call this good citizenship, and being a very widespread belief system that frames this lethal self-defense, where did this idea come from?
Yeah, so in many ways, what I found out in my book, and I am trained as a historian, so I tend to look to the past to try to understand why we behave the way that we do, why the kinds of structures that we have in place, where they came from. So in many ways, this notion of good citizenship as armed and prepared citizenship is not really that new. It's just this amplification that's really new. So really, I looked back in time to try to trace the ways in which specifically our nation has addressed cases of insecurity and self-defense. And I found that I needed to go way, way back before there was the United States to look at the way our legal doctrine around self-defense originated in English common law doctrine. So I looked at something called the duty to retreat, which originates with English common law back in the day, before there was even a United States. The king was the only one who was authorized to use violence to avenge a crime or to protect a citizen from a crime. The only way in which you could fight back is, if somebody was attacking you, is if after you had tried to get away, after you had retreated to the wall behind your back. And the only exception to that was the castle doctrine. So if you were in your home, also called your castle, you could fight back with lethal self-defense in that case. So to make a long story short, I trace the way in which the castle doctrine morphs into something very different here in the United States, which I describe as a selective exception to the duty to retreat that specifically adheres in white propertied masculinity in the United States.
Yeah. And so states have really divided up then between full on embracing stand your ground, like we see in Florida, and also states that kind of blur the line with this castle type doctrine.
Exactly. And the really complicated thing is, and I'm not a legal scholar, so a lot of this is really complicated and something that a lot of legal scholars have been grappling with, is that, you know, you mentioned 33 odd states have adopted some kind of version of a stand your ground law since 2005, and Florida was the first one to adopt the stand your ground law. They really vary from state to state. So, like, Florida, I would say, is among the most robust, meaning that you don't have a duty to retreat wherever you may legally be. So it's not just about your castle or your home or even your vehicle. You can be in a public place, and if you feel like you're under threat, you don't have to retreat before fighting back. So there's so much variety in the way these different jurisdictions adjudicate a citizen's right to self-defense.
We're talking with Caroline Light. Her new book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Caroline, let's talk a little bit more here about the demographics of gun ownership and how that tells a story about Stand Your Ground. You mentioned gun-owning males protecting their property, which gives us, you know, an inkling of what perhaps is going on here.
Yeah, it's really complicated, and I wanna caution that guns are just a part of the puzzle. It's really what I'm trying to say in my book is that a lot of it is about ideology, and specifically a fear-driven ideology that a good citizen is he who is prepared to defend himself and his property and his dependents against a litany of encroaching threats. So those threats would include, violent criminals and the so-called terrorist and the so-called illegal immigrant, that there's this multiplicity of threats that we need to be prepared to defend ourselves against. And then guns enter the scene as sort of a tool by which that ideology gets realized. So, over the past few decades, a lot of things have changed. For instance, back in the 80s, there were a bunch of states that didn't even allow civilian concealed carry, and as of 2014, all of the states in the United States have some kind of option for concealed carry for citizens, and there's a lot of variation. Again, just like stand your ground laws, there's so much variation between the states. Recently, I think the count is about 12 states that have something called constitutional carry or permitless carry, which essentially means that law-abiding citizens of a particular age, so you need to be an adult, may carry a concealed weapon without any permit and without any training. And so this has been very controversial, as you can imagine, because it means that we don't even know who's carrying a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And law enforcement, for instance, doesn't know. And when you get in an argument or an incident of road rage, you don't know. The presumption in those jurisdictions is consider everybody armed. So there's a lot changing right now in terms of not just the parameters of justifiable homicide through stand your ground laws, but also who has weapons and who's carrying weapons with them into public space. So there's a really complex geography around this too.
And Eric from Beloit called in. He couldn't stay with us. He wants to better understand the difference between what is self-defense and what is stand your ground.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. I'm not going to answer it as a legal question, but more sort of the ideological question. What is self-defense? Well, you know, in our history, wherever you look in U.S. history, there's this articulation of a natural human right to defend yourself. In other words, it's considered deeply un-American to just stand there and take a beating. You're supposed to defend yourself when you're attacked. Legally, what happens over time, standing your ground is this idea that you don't have to try to get away. So it enhances the parameters of under what circumstances you should fight back. In early American tradition, you were at least supposed to try to get away if you were not in your own home. Standing your ground today has become generalized to wherever a person may legally be. But as I caution in my book, we have a very long history in the United States of selectively upholding that right to defend yourself for particular kinds of people. And I try in my book to unpack that tradition using critical lenses from gender studies, ethnic studies, African-American studies, looking at the extent to which human identity, as much as we want to believe that we're a society that's colorblind, that's gender equitable, that's class blind, we are very much rooted to traditions of seeing threats in particular kinds of ways that implicate gender, race, and class. So that's a long way to answer that question, but I would say the difference between self-defense just alone and standing your ground is a difference of degree. With stand your ground, the implication is that you don't move, you don't try to get away if someone attacks you. And with self-defense, you know, you could try to get away, you could try
you
to
retreat.
Avoid. Yeah. you could retreat. And I just want to keep in front of us this idea that those things, as theoretically as we want to talk about them, never happen in an ideological vacuum. We live in a society that continues to be plagued by implicit biases. And so when we're deciding who's actually a real threat to us, we're always already engaged in a certain kind of calculus of threat.
Let's discuss the rise of neighborhood watch programs and citizens becoming quasi-police protectors. This came to the forefront when George Zimmerman, the 29-year-old who shot and killed Trayvon Martin in Florida. Trayvon
right.
seemed suspicious in a hooded sweatshirt. But let's listen to a bit here of Trayvon's mother, Sabrina Fulton, testifying before a congressional subcommittee in 2013.
He was not the criminal that the person who shot and killed him thought that he was. He was simply on the cell phone talking to a young lady in Miami with candy and a drink. As I think about this as a mother, and I think about how many kids walk to the store and how many kids now feel that they cannot be safe in their own community, I think about what kind of message we are sending as parents, as lawmakers, as elected officials, even as grandparents and aunts and uncles. What kind of message are we sending if our kids, because remember, these are our kids in our communities, don't feel safe. Don't feel safe simply walking to the store to get candy and a drink. So I just wanted to come here to talk to you for a moment to let you know how important it is that we amend this Stand Your Ground, because it did not, certainly did not work in my case.
And so Zimmerman was acquitted. There were protests. Explain this clash between protection of property and equal rights and how this was, how those two just knocked together here.
Oh, wow. So many layers. And it really is. It's moving to hear Mrs. Fulton's voice. And Trayvon would have turned 22 years old just a couple days ago had he lived, had he survived that encounter with the neighborhood watch, George Zimmerman. That case exemplifies the blind spots of Stand Your Ground laws, the way in which even if you read the Stand Your Ground law, the letter of the law, the way that it's articulated, there's not a trace of any reference to race or class or gender. It's gender-inclusive language. The way these laws are articulated is that they are made to seem universal, that all of us can benefit by having this enhanced capacity to defend ourselves when we feel threatened. Now, the problem is they are not adjudicated in a way that is equitable, that is colorblind. And as Mrs. Fulton eloquently articulates in that moment that you just played, what message are we sending? And I think that's at the heart of it. What message are we sending? What I think happens is that the laws become a license to kill when you feel afraid, when you feel reasonably under threat, and neighborhood watch programs, which ultimately were started in the late 20th century as a way to get neighbors involved in keeping each other safe. I mean, in a lot of ways, this neighborhood watch program emerged out of a collective effort to look after each other. So you look back, and it really does seem like such a laudable way to bring people together to get to know each other better and to look after each other. But I believe what's happened in a lot of jurisdictions, not just in that Florida jurisdiction, is that Neighborhood Watch has become a way of militarizing certain civilians who then feel it their duty to violently patrol and protect private property. And they're doing so, of course, with that calculus of threat that I mentioned before, which is inflected by unacknowledged implicit biases. Trayvon Martin was a teenage boy, unarmed, wearing a hoodie, and the color of his skin, not to mention his gender, are what triggered George Zimmerman to see him as a threat to property in that moment. And rather than wait for law enforcement to arrive on the scene as he was instructed, Zimmerman felt empowered to take the law into his own hands and to attack Trayvon. And so, absolutely, this is a whole mix of problematic assumptions about who's in need of protection, the extent to which we need to protect predominantly white property, and the militarization of civilians, which is also a major problem in all of this. So, and it was in response to that episode in particular that I began my work on this book.
We're talking with Caroline Light. Her new book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. We're looking at the evolution of Stand Your Ground laws, sometimes also called Shoot First laws. Florida has been at the forefront of Stand Your Ground. It also got a thumbs up by the National Rifle Association. It was adopted, Stand Your Ground, by the state legislature despite widespread opposition in 2005. What do you think of Stand Your Ground laws, and do you think Wisconsin should adopt Stand Your Ground and follow the lead of states like Florida? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll be back after this short break here on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our conversation about Stand Your Ground now, laws that allow individuals to use lethal force if they fear their lives are in jeopardy. A recent study by JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, found that gun-related homicides went up 31% since the law went into effect. Our guest this hour is helping us understand the history of Stand Your Ground. Caroline Light directs the undergraduate studies program in women, gender, and sexuality studies at Harvard University. Her new book is on the history of Stand Your Ground. And let's go right to our callers now with Mary from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hello, and I think you might have touched on this a little earlier, but I think if a white man were threatening a white woman and she stood her ground and shot him, it probably change the scenario. If it turned out to be a black or Hispanic woman that stood their ground against a white man, I think that would change the scenario even more. So I think this really is a law that's just opening the doors for a whole lot of can of worms.
Yeah, Mary, I absolutely agree. And actually, there are also a lot of cases around domestic violence that prove that stand-your-ground laws are adjudicated in a way that's anything but equitable, anything but universal. There are a lot of cases where women fight back against violent spouses, whether they're in their house or outside. And depending on a lot of different factors, most often those women are going to end up in prison. I'm sure people are familiar with the case of Marissa Alexander, and she's from Florida as well, and or actually she might be from Georgia. She is from a strong stand-your-ground state, and she was sent to prison after firing a warning shot at her abusive spouse, who was unwilling to let her leave the house. And as an African-American woman, she was characterized as being angry rather than fearful. So part of the adjudication of stand your ground has to do with whether you can prove to the judge and jury that you were, quote-unquote, reasonable in your perception of fear. And with domestic violence survivors, it's very difficult to prove that you were reasonable and that there was an imminent threat. So she was in prison for several years and then under house arrest and was just released. I believe it was Florida.
It was Florida, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was adjudicated by some of the same people who adjudicated the Zimmerman case, who was acquitted because his fears of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old boy, were deemed reasonable.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm a practicing attorney in Wisconsin, a criminal defense, and I've had tragic cases where armed homeowners dealt with intruders by use of weapons, and then had the unarmed intruders take the weapons away, and the circumstances of the event harm the homeowner. So I've dealt with cases where this stand your ground castle doctrine has, you know, adverse consequences. But the point I want to do is draw an analogy to the death penalty. The two strongest stand your ground states are Florida and Texas. They also have mm-hmm. the highest rate of the use of the death penalty of all the other states combined. And what we've seen from statistics is that the rate of homicide has no correlation to the death penalty. That Florida and Texas has twice the homicide rates of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, non-death penalty states. Because homicide rates are directly correlative to two things, poverty and population density. So this mm-hmm. deterrent argument, I think the death penalty is growing in disfavor because the fallacy of the argument has been shown, and I believe that this new stand your ground is a sort of new form of death penalty fallacy argument, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Wow. Yeah, Jim, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about I wasn't even aware of the correlation with death penalty and homicide, and particularly Florida and Texas, but that is fascinating to me. I don't even know what to say except that I wonder what the correlation too is with self-defensive gun ownership too, and concealed carry laws, open carry practices, and things like that. I wonder if there's also a correlation there as well.
And Caroline, a lot of gun critics would be quick to point out to people that the role of the NRA is in the mix here. How would you describe the National Rifle Association's influence here, or if at all?
Well, I do think there's been a pretty powerful role of the NRA in promoting the ideology of armed citizenship. Since around the late 1970s, the NRA, which originated as an apolitical organization whose main goal was to promote gun safety, transitioned radically in the late 20th century into what we know it to be now, which is very much about a sort of strict Second Amendment rights as translated to be individual rights to own weapons for self-defensive kinds of actions. The NRA has really worked hard to promote this idea that a good citizen is an armed citizen. To quote Wayne LaPierre, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And so the NRA has promoted a kind of folklore that, in response to our heightened insecurities, and especially in the wake of mass shootings, that our best solution is for more people to own guns. So, for instance, the response to the Sandy Hook tragedy was bring guns into the schools. If we have good citizens with guns in the schools, we can protect everybody. And the response to campus shootings is, well, we need the undergraduates to carry around guns. So it's sort of the NRA has promoted this notion, the ideology of the do-it-yourself security citizen, but also this notion that the more guns, the safer we'll be. And I think many scholars in public health, for instance, have shown that the more guns you have, the more gun deaths you have.
Well, let's take another call now. Steve from Green Bay. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, according to the laws now, I would not be incarcerated for standing up for another individual. What my particular instance 20 years ago, being released from the Marine Corps on a trip at a park, there were some younger kids throwing things at an older gentleman. One threatened him with a stick. I stood in between him and the assailant. Ultimately, I stopped everything and ended up getting arrested. That wouldn't happen today. Ultimately, it got thrown out of court because of I was just defending the guy. It's a little different for me. I'm actually good with my hands. I don't require a gun or a stick. But I'm just saying, in some instances, I can understand how this is beneficial.
You mean enhanced capacity to defend yourself and to defend others?
Correct. It wasn't my fight. But unfortunately, that's the way I was trained, to stand in between those who can't defend themselves.
Right. Yeah, you were defending somebody who couldn't defend himself against probably stronger individuals, right? But then ultimately you were criminalized because in the eyes of law enforcement, it looked like you were threatening children or something, right?
Yeah, they were all of age. All of these people who were trying to get money from this guy were all, I want to say, 18 to 20 years old. There was five of them.
Oh, okay.
There was one
they weren't like little kids. Okay.
No, it wasn't like little, 10-year-old kids.
Right, right.
And
yeah,
with the laws that are now in place, I wouldn't have to do anything more than to justify why I did what I did.
Probably, although I wonder, I'm not sure, because if you've been following these different kinds of cases, I don't think the law is, in other words, I don't think law enforcement necessarily acts in an ideological vacuum either. So a lot of questions I would have would be, for instance, what is the race of the kids? What's the race of the person whom you're defending? And then your own race, too. So, if, let's just think kind of hypothetically, if you are an African-American man defending, say, an elderly African-American from a bunch of white youths, it's going to look different to law enforcement than if you're a white person defending a white elderly person from African-American youth. Do you see what I'm saying?
I understand. I get when people throw the race card in. I understand that. It can be perceived differently than what it actually was. Just for the record, I'm a white guy. The elderly gentleman was a black individual, and the kids were mixed. There was five of them, black, white. It was just a group of thugs.
Yeah, interesting.
Interesting.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, and it definitely is food for thought. I also wonder, too, Steve, like, what jurisdiction, too. I actually think these things have to be geographically considered, too, and I'm not trying to say it's always all about race. It's also about gender. Women are treated differently in terms of their ability to defend themselves against particular actors as well. But your jurisdiction is going to mean a lot, too, whether you're in an urban space or rural or, you know, in a shopping mall parking lot. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of, different factors to consider in the way law enforcement are going to act in these cases. But it does sound like you were just trying to do the right thing and you were criminalized for it.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for your call. And I want to follow up with something you said, Caroline. Judy from Reedstown wants to talk about the vulnerability that happens when retreating. She wrote to us and said some people, some women like her, of her size, feel it's safer to stand your ground.
Yeah, certainly. And that's another thing about the sort of proliferation of guns. It means that ever since we've developed rapid fire, you know, easy loading or automatically loading weapons, it isn't quite practical to expect people to retreat to the wall but behind their back when the person attacking you has a lethal weapon. So that makes it really hard. And certainly guns aren't always a factor, but in a lot of cases they are, and so definitely. Now, I would ask, too, just as a follow-up, is she saying that just fighting back gives her a better shot as a smaller person who's attacked by perhaps a man or somebody bigger?
Yeah, and we don't know. It just sounds like she's feeling perhaps it would be safer for a woman like her to have a stand your ground law on her side.
Yes, exactly. But as I said before, and I fully agree with that. So the other thing, too, is that there's been in the past, I'd say decade, a proliferation of groups that are groups representing women, people of color, LGBTQ-identified people who have been targets of violence. As we know in this nation, women are, people of color are, trans or gender nonconforming people are targets of violence, civilian and police violence in particular, for the latter two groups. Doesn't it make sense, then, for those groups to take up arms, to learn how to use lethal self-defense to protect themselves from other more dominant, more powerful social actors? And I would say that on the surface, absolutely. And this is the reason why so many more women now are possessing firearms, getting trained in firearm safety and use, getting concealed carry permits, etc. However, what I discovered in my book is that the law does not protect us all equally. As I mentioned before, women are much more likely to be endangered, not by strangers lurking in the bushes, but by men they actually know. Statistically, more women, especially if we're thinking about, for instance, sexual violence, women are more often vulnerable to sexual violence from people they know. So the fact is, the law doesn't always protect women who are survivors of sexual violence, especially when it's perpetrated by somebody they know. What would the law do if a woman who was threatened with sexual assault from, say, an ex-boyfriend took a gun and shot him? And just judging by the cases that I've seen, chances are the woman would end up criminalized herself for standing her ground and using lethal self-defense. In other words, our law is not gender or color blind when it comes to adjudicating cases of self-defense. We can think back to the case of Marissa Alexander, we can sort of think about the statistics on sexual assault and on domestic violence.
We're talking with Caroline Light. She's the author of Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Dozens of states have some form of Stand Your Ground law. However, some states have been moving away from it, introducing bills to repeal or scale back Stand Your Ground. We'll get more of your thoughts and your calls but we're going to be taking a short break here. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Caroline Light about the history of Stand Your Ground laws and what implications they have in America. She's director of undergraduate studies in the program in Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Harvard and author of a new book on Stand Your Ground. And let's go to the phones now with John from Madison. Hi, John.
Yes, hello. I really believe that Stand Your Ground is basically a sales tactic by the gun manufacturers. I mean, the gun manufacturers need to sell guns. They have to have a law that will make it easy to sell guns. And they basically they buy a congressman who they say, you know, if you don't promote Stand Your Ground laws, we won't fund your election. So corporate America needs to sell guns so they have a law and they make it easy to sell guns.
That is definitely legitimate. There have been many who have argued that there's a very powerful corporate force behind the spread of these laws. The NRA obviously has a tight connection with corporate interests in gun manufacturing, and some have proposed that given the waning interest of our nation in hunting around the late 20th century, there was a need by the manufacturers to figure out a way to cultivate a new urgent need for guns. And so it makes perfect sense that you'd want to stoke fear and promote a sense that you're in danger and the only solution to that perceived danger is to carry your own personal weapon. And certainly in the past couple of decades, we've seen an increase in the number of guns in the United States. I think we now have more firearms than we have actual human beings in the United States. So we possess something like 40-50% of the whole world's guns, but only about 5% of the population in our nation. So yes, the proliferation of guns is a big part of this, and certainly there seems to be a parallel trajectory. The spread of Stand Your Ground laws or enhanced Castle Doctrine laws seems to follow or be followed by enhanced or more robust concealed carry allowances for civilians. So definitely, it's a heightened militarization, and it sure does serve the interests of gun manufacturers.
John, thanks so much for your call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about Stand Your Ground. Let's now go to Robert in Wapaka. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
What would you like to add? I hear your radio on in the background, too.
I guess I would like to ask your guest if she is aware of any of these type of laws existing in any other developed democracies in the world.
Caroline?
Oh, Robert, that's a good question. I don't. I really don't. I think that this is something I'd love to do more research on and see if there's anything even close to what we've got here. But in general, what I hear and what I read, I'm currently reading a brand new book on human rights and personal self-defense in international law. What I get so far is the sense that the United States is quite different from most other peer nations. So as I mentioned before, you know, our common law foundations are in many ways derived from British common law, but as far back as the early Republic in the United States, our nation developed in a way that was unique. We did away with the duty to retreat quite quickly once the United States became a separate entity. So far, I do not know of a peer nation that has a similar disposition in relation to lethal self-defense. But that's not to say I'm not continuing my search.
Caroline, is there any evidence, or what would happen if these laws were to go away tomorrow? Would that really solve some of the problems we're talking about here with gun deaths and more violence?
Yeah, you know what? People who know me know that I'm an optimist, but in this regard, I'm not. I think that the laws, the stand your ground laws, the sort of spread of gun culture and spread of armed citizenship, I think the stand your ground laws are just one piece of an enormous constellation in a larger set of ideologies that revolve around a sense of deep insecurity, urgent fear and insecurity, and that ultimately make us think that we ourselves have to violently protect ourselves and what we have. And in many ways, it somewhat defies logic. There's a lot of evidence out there gleaned from public health, for instance, that shows that self-defensive gun use is not the norm. that shows that, as one of the callers said, that disproportionately when you have a gun in the house, that the gun gets used by the perpetrator against the homeowner, the gun owner. And in spite of all this evidence, we're accumulating these weapons that were designed specifically to kill. So I would love to be able to say that eradicating these laws is going to really help, but it's just one piece of a much larger puzzle. And then on top of all of that, overlaid on everything, is the fact that in spite of all of our invocations of colorblind and gender equitable universality in this nation, we are anything but equal. And our law is still adjudicated in ways that favor the powerful at the expense of the socially vulnerable.
Let's take another call now with Mike from Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What would you like to add?
Hey, I just wanted to get your opinion on something. I'm a truck driver that hauls high-value freight, and I haul into a lot of really dangerous neighborhoods and areas. I'm a licensed carry-conceal person, and I don't agree with standard ground laws by any means. But I'm wondering if we had a national registry and had, like, just one law that covers all states for purchasing, possession, concealment of firearms, and one law that's across all states on either you have stand your ground or you don't, would that maybe help with some of the problems that we're experiencing these days?
So, Mike, I didn't hear. I heard part of what you said. You're suggesting if we had one
uniformity
registry.
Yeah, he's a truck driver who is licensed to carry. But doesn't agree with stand your ground. However, he's wondering whether a national registry and uniformity would make an impact here.
So that, I think, is really interesting, actually. I don't know. I do think a registry is a good idea, because part of the problem that I'm finding as a researcher is that it's very difficult to track who even has concealed carry licenses, who's actually carrying. We don't have a good means of tracking these things, and I do think that it would help if people were accountable and if law enforcement in particular had access to a registry, just to know who's licensed, who's trained, who has the guns. But as I mentioned before, there does seem to be a trend towards constitutional carry or permitless carry, and that's via a, I would say, a radical interpretation of the Second Amendment that all civilians, all law-abiding citizens should be able to carry without any restrictions. So that runs counter to what you're suggesting, and I'm actually kind of worried that it's not likely that the states would allow for federal oversight over regulations and even tracking who's got a weapon and who's licensed to carry where and whatever. But I think that's a really interesting suggestion.
Mike, thanks for your call. Let's now go to Dan in Delavan. Hi, Dan.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call. I am a master martial artist with many, many years of experience in teaching, and I have curious for your guest about any of the Stand Your Ground research she's done about non-armed, meaning people that are highly trained enough that they could use lethal force if they had to. I don't condone that in any way, but any of your research about how that's maybe come about in people defending themselves, transgender or otherwise, women, and the effects of that or possibility of being prosecuted for that in your research. Is there any information that you have available?
Dan, that's a really interesting question. You know, it isn't always about guns. Now, what I don't know very much about is the extent to which people use martial arts to defend themselves. Instead, what I do see is evidence of people using whatever they have on hand to protect themselves. So there was a famous case of Cece McDonald a few years back, a black transgender woman who was attacked, I believe, in a parking lot by a group of white people yelling homophobic and racist things at her, and she tried to escape, and I believe she was carrying in her purse a pair of scissors that she carried because she was frequently subject to sort of hateful behavior. And she used the scissors and ended up killing one of the perpetrators who was attacking her. She ended up serving time in jail. And so I look to her as sort of an example of somebody who isn't using a gun and who was not in a stand your ground state, but still she retreated as far as she possibly could, and yet the prosecution and judge and jury couldn't quite see her as somebody who was reasonably afraid. So that doesn't really answer your question. One thing I do want to say about martial arts and training without weapons is that in the 1970s and 80s, there was a movement for women to receive martial arts training. There was something called model mugging, which I think still is in existence today, where women learned how to use their body weight in ways to throw off an attacker. And the focus was not on guns or weapons. The focus was on using what you've got to escape an attacker alive. Now, I do think, however, that's sort of a thing of the past, because most of what I see today is that more and more women are just buying guns and going to the shooting range and getting a license instead of getting martial arts training. And I'm not so sure what that's about, but I do think there is a shift to the more lethal kinds of remedies for one's sense of insecurity.
Caroline Light, what needs to change here, and are we capable as an American society of making these changes?
Wow, that's a million-dollar question. So because I'm a historian, I tend to say people need to learn their history. I do think it's illuminating, and I do think we live in a particular moment right now where we want a comfortable, whitewashed history, and that doesn't cut it. I think we have to acknowledge the extent to which our own Constitution, all of our legal foundations, our criminal justice system, all of these structures that we often take for granted are very much mired in basic, powerful structures of inequality that concentrate power and security into the hands of the few at the expense of the many. So the first thing that needs to happen is I really think we need to acknowledge the ways in which that exclusionary, violent past continues to haunt our present.
Yeah. And very quickly here, we have about 30 seconds. Where do you see Stand Your Ground laws headed in the future for states? Because there's been ebb and flow here a bit.
There has been, but I have a lot of reason to believe that we've not seen the end of them. I think we're going to see more robust stand your ground laws spreading beyond the just 30 or so states. I also think we're going to see more states going to constitutional or permitless carry. So I actually see the enhancement of armed citizenship in the next few years.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Caroline Light is the author of Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. It was published last month. We can continue this conversation about Stand Your Ground over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at this time, the Good Food and Buy Local Food movements have arrived at school cafeterias near you. We'll hear about a national school lunch program that's serving up healthier nutrition to students. And we'll also hear about a school lunch program right here in Madison. Hope you can join us tomorrow at this time. Thanks to Chris Molina and Marika Saval for producing this hour. We had on-air production help today from Jennifer Dargan and technical direction from Dave Potras. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for a vacationing Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.